love to hear your stories, but I actually don't know sort of like your beginnings, how you got into martial arts in the first place.
Did you martial arts in 1972. I was 12. And me and a friend of mine got attacked by a dog. And we jumped up on a car to get away from the dog. We didn't get hurt by the dog, but the dog was, I can't say we were attacked. The dog was barking at us, so we thought it was going to attack. And we looked at each other and both said, I bet you if we knew karate, we could have beat the dog. So we started looking around. At that time, there was not a lot of choice. Yes. At that time, you did judo at the recreational center, or you did Junri Taekwondo.
This was you grew up around here?
1972. I grew up in Crofton, which is right outside of Annapolis. Mm-hmm. And in Bowie, they had a Junri. Okay. So I went there. I had a grandmother that passed away. She left me $100, which may not seem like a lot now, but it was a lot then. Yeah. It paid for a period of time at the Taekwondo school. That was my choice to spend it like that. And then I trained, by myself because I couldn't afford any more after that for a year or so while I played sports in school. And then my parents, realizing I was not a really good student for a large part of my life, and I was undisciplined and lacked direction. And so my parents had seen how much interest I'd had in martial arts, so they actually paid for me to start taking karate in Beltsville at a karate school that taught Shorinru and Wing Chun, which really wasn't Wing Chun, but it was mostly Shorinru. Mm-hmm. And I studied there for a while, and I realized that's not really what I wanted, so I started looking for... I wanted to study animal system kung fu. That's what I wanted to study. Because, I had been raised, and this is 1976, so... I was watching the Kung Fu TV series, and I'd seen some of the Bruce Lee movies and all that, and I wanted to learn the animal styles, because I thought that was it. So I saw in the paper they were having a demonstration of Bando in Glen Burnie, which I don't know if you know where Glen Burnie is.
Yes, sir.
In Glen Burnie, and at the high school there in 77, and so I had read about Bando. I knew it had animal systems, so I said, I'm going to go watch that. I really liked it. Afterwards, I walked up. Dr. G was the guest there, of course.
Really? This is very early on.
Yes, in 77. G was the guest. He wasn't he didn't organize the demo, but because he was the founder of Bando in this country, he was there because he was all of these instructors' teacher. And I walked up and I introduced myself, which I guess, I think back's kind of bold for a 17-year-old kid, and said, where can I train this? And that's when he sent me to Catonsville Community College, which is where I met my Bando teacher, John Collins, who I've been with since 1977, so it's at 40 years.
Oh, wow.
And I walked in, I had this beautiful white kung fu gi, it was great, and I told him, I walk in, everybody's dressed in shorts and t-shirts and tank tops, because it was Bando, and I didn't realize that the animal systems were kind of secondary, especially at this Bando club. And I told John, who, I introduced myself, and I said, I wanted to learn the animal system. So he called one of the kickboxers over, named Tommy Strasberg, who I, got to know real well, to teach me a tiger set. And so I spent that next 2-3 hours while at the club in Catonsville. And it was a club. It wasn't a school. It was at the community college.
Yes, sir.
So it was like the club I run. And he taught me the tiger set. And I thought, this is great. This is what I want to learn. I came back the next time, but I was smart. I wore shorts, and I didn't wear my fancy gi, and he put me in a kickboxing ring that time, didn't give me a choice, and from then on, that's pretty much what I did.
Wow.
Now, a year or two later, I started studying all of the various aspects of Bando, which include the animals, but in Bando, back then, which was very hardcore, you learned to kickbox first, period, and it was very hard, you sparred a lot of drills, things like that. John and another senior Bando guy, who was actually John's teacher, named Bob Maxwell. He's one of the seniors of Bando now, one of the old guys, elders they call him, felt that I had a lot of talent, so they had me start competing, even though I didn't like fighting. Mm-hmm. As funny as I never liked fighting. I just happened to be pretty good at it.
Were these Bando, like Bando leagues?
Well, no, what we did is, back then, you did a lot of what's called smokers.
Yes,
and what a smoker is it's competition, but it's not sanctioned.
Yes, sir.
So it wouldn't officially count on your record if there was a record to be kept.
Mm-hmm.
All right. See, today it would make a difference because records are important. If you go to UFC or the kickboxing things, you can't count the smokers. You're not supposed to because they're not sanctioned. And they still have, like I might go over to your school, we arrange a competition, we match our guys up, and they fight. And it's just like a regular thing in a ring and all, the bell and everything. But it's not sanctioned, so it doesn't count. So we did a lot of that, but we did a lot of that with other schools. Bonner was one of the first to do that. They wanted to go out and test themselves against Taekwondo and karate and kung fu. There weren't that many other different styles out there. And certainly Thai boxing was not evident yet. I'm sure it was in this country because I know Chai was here, but it wasn't evident, at least in this part of the country, where you could find a Thai boxing club. So you either fought other Bando schools, you fought Taekwondo schools, occasionally Kung Fu school.
Wow.
Like, what was the, Dennis Brown and Willie Lins once in a while, you know, things like that. So, and I believe I've been told that there are examples of those on YouTube, that somebody's put some of the old fights, competitions between the Bando clubs and some of the karate schools. And I had a massage therapist a few years ago who knew one of the old-time karate guys in Baltimore. I mean, really old-time guys. I knew who he was, and I'd met him, but he was quite a bit older than me. And his club was very hardcore, and they used to spar a lot. The DC Dragons, which I think is still around, they're very hard training, and they would spar with us, fight with us. And most of the time, they would fight our rules, which usually wasn't, we didn't have elbows, but knees and leg kicks, which for Taekwondo is, if you allow leg kicks, you know, Taekwondo people didn't train that, and their legs, they like kick them high, but you get leg kicks, you can't kick high anymore. So that's how I stayed with John for, I mean, I was going away to college and stuff, but I always went back and trained with him. But 77, come 82, 83, I've been competing a lot. I've been training, you know, 4 or 5 hours a day since I was 17. I was starting to get a little burnt out, and I'd always read about, again, you know, you had the Bruce Lee. And, and I actually wanted to study Filipino arts more than Jeet Kune Do. I really was never interested in Jeet Kune Do that much, maybe because of my kickboxing, I felt that. And that's how I met, it was John, my Bonner teacher, who told me about Master Fred.
Okay.
And because John had known him, because Master Fred's school was a mile and a half or 2 miles up from Catonsville Community College in Arbutus.
Okay.
His original Taekwondo school. And so I went there, and he had his Arnis classes on. Is that mine? Stop that for a second. But he. So John told me about Master Fred. I went up and introduced myself. Master Fred had a Arnis class on Friday nights, which was perfect because it didn't interfere. And if you know anything about the history of the Filipino arts in this country, especially on the East Coast, I can't speak a lot for the West Coast, but it was most common. Well, you did. The only place you really found Filipino martial arts, Arnis at the time, and Kalakali Arnis, was at Taekwondo schools.
I guess that's true. I never thought about that.
And the reason, I'll tell you the reason it was explained to me, and I can't say that there's any empirical evidence for this, but it was my Filipino teachers who explained this to me, both those that taught at Taekwondo schools and those I met years later. When, you know, the Filipino arts are a great system. They've always been around, but they've always been very guarded, protected.
That's true.
Very family-oriented. And when they decided that they wanted to start trying to promote them out in the in this country more, they realized that they couldn't compete against Taekwondo schools because they were ubiquitous. They were everywhere. So, and the very, you know, very smart, I don't know if it was Tuan Gahi himself or a number of Filipino masters that thought this simultaneously, but I certainly know that, that Tuan Gahi and Remy Priestess did this, is they would go to Taekwondo schools and say, y'all are here, but y'all don't have any weapons. Mm-hmm. And we have this system. It's a weapon system. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to provide to, or tell the Taekwondo people that, well, we have everything. Because they didn't want them to feel like they were competing.
Yes, sir.
So they said, we have a weapon system. It's a very good. It's very structured. It's fairly simple to learn. A lot of fun stuff to do. And it would basically, I'll use management term, it would provide you with an alternate revenue stream.
Yes, sir.
All right. And it would complement. It wouldn't compete, but it would complement what you already have. Mm-hmm. All right. Because, again, the Filipinos, their empty hand system, I don't want to say it was superior because you can't really say, but it was, yeah. It was much more developed, certainly, than Taekwondo because it had so many different aspects. It was a lot like the Burmese arts in that you had empty hand punching, kicking, striking, the grappling, throwing, locks, things like that, mm-hmm. none of which the Taekwondo really had since Taekwondo was basically developed as a sport.
Yes, sir.
So that's why back in the 70s, the Arnis were always in Taekwondo schools. Mm-hmm. And so I went to Master Fred's Taekwondo school. He was teaching Pekita Tersha under Tuhan Gahi. Mm-hmm. He took a liking to me right away, I guess maybe because I was a little tougher, you know. He could do a little more with me. I don't know why he liked me so much, but he would call me into his office after class was over, and we would talk for hours.
Wow.
And it was interesting because he had a real thick accent, and we'd be talking. And he'd go, "Yeah, Pot, let me tell you about the Filipino arts. See, we know the hands and the feet, and, you know, on the feet you've got 10 twos." And I go, "Well, 10 twos, what?" Because he had this real thick accent. I couldn't understand. And he'd talk about, again, being from the Philippines, his dialect didn't pronounce F's, so it's Filipino.
Yep.
And I won't tell you about some of the rawer language he used where he couldn't pronounce the F's either. But let's just say that it was hilarious. You know, and he and I would talk a lot about that. And this is actually also where I met Master Carlos, because mm-hmm. he was in the same class, as was Master Fred's two kids, two boys, and a number of other people who I'm sure I'm forgetting. Leo was there too.
So, and Felix, was he also in that Felix
Cortez? I believe he was, yes. I believe everybody was in it, because we were all, you know, this is 1982. So that's almost 35 years ago.
Wow, yeah.
So I don't know how old Felix is right now. He certainly trained with us, so I'll have to assume, yeah, he was in that class. And Father Leo, who wasn't Father then, but it was Leo, and Master, you know, Master Carlos, and all of them were all there. And, you know, we had a great old time, yeah. A lot of old-fashioned training with the, you know, and Master Fred would take out his machete, and we'd be doing, you know, different drills where you'd, like, have to turn and stuff. And Master Fred had the habit of talking like this, so it wasn't looking at you. So you had to do it right,
yes, sir.
Or you got stabbed. Now, luckily, I don't think they were really sharp, so even if he stabbed you, you never bled or anything, but he kind of worried about it.
Sure, of course.
And so it was a lot of fun, and, you know, over the years, I remember, you know, what happened, that actually opened the door for the Philippines, and I realized how much I really enjoyed it. And it might be that the Filipino arts are in a lot of ways, are very similar to Burmese arts, so there may have been that connection. But I had always read about Guru Dan. And the opportunity presented itself. I had a brother who was a Naval Academy graduate a few years prior, and he had just been stationed at Long Beach. And so I said, literally, he had just been stationed that spring. And I said, well, this is going to be the opportunity for me to go train with, you know, Dan Anasanta, you know, Bruce Lee guy. Yeah, I got to go. And so I took a lot of chances because I'd never met him. I talked to John. I talked to Dr. G., Dr. G wrote me a letter. Dr. G had published a book on Burmese boxing that he signed for, and I figured, well, this stuff will help get me in. Kind of like the old-fashioned way where your teacher introduces you through letter and whatnot. And so I went and went out there, stayed with my brother for the summer, but I went out to the Torrance School, his original Kali Academy, walked in. Interestingly enough, it was during the day. He wasn't there, but Paul Vunak was watching the desk.
Oh, wow.
And so I talked to Paul a little bit, and, you know, I had a few questions about things like, again, I'm a 22-year-old kid. I'm a high school, about the end of my high school senior, or my college senior year. And so I was talking to Paul, and I said, you know, how do you combine Wing Chun? Because I had studied Wing Chun, and I left some out. At 18, when I graduated high school, I went down to Louisiana for a couple of years.
Oh, really?
And my parents, I'm from Louisiana, and my father had gotten transferred up here when I was 6. He got transferred back down there when I was 17, so I stayed up here to finish school.
Mm-hmm.
And I went down for a couple of years. I studied Wing Chun down there while I was down there, in addition to keeping my Bondo training up. And I actually fought down there. I did a lot of competing down there. Louisiana State University, where I was a freshman, had a full contact team.
Oh, wow.
Which was, well, we formed it, but it was sent, you know, it was sponsored by the college, and it was interesting because we had different stylists. I had one guy who was some kind of real extravagant kung fu, and then I had another guy who was a karate guy, and, you know, we all trained together as a club, and we had a Golden Glove boxing champ who was our coach.
Nice.
And so, you know, I studied the Wing Chun down there, and when I got to California and I asked Paul Vunak, how do you combine them? And this is how enlightenment, I guess, he goes, you don't combine them, you flow from one range to the other. But see, that idea had never occurred to me. Right? That, because I was always saying, how did Bruce Lee combine, you know, the Wing Chun and the kickboxing and all that? And then that night I came back and Guru Dan was there and I introduced myself. And little known secret, which was, I didn't know it at the time, I found this out years later, is, you know, Guru Dan had a personal goal. And his goal was, he wanted to study every martial art.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he was an intellectual, an academic, And from that perspective, he wanted, and he didn't want to study it to be the baddest dude in the world. He wanted to study it from that intellectual academic perspective. Sure. He wanted to try to understand the unifying principles that exist, if there are any.
Mm-hmm.
And he had never met a Bondo guy. And so this opened the door for him in his mind. And so he welcomed me in. I mean, literally, he took me under his wing from day one, which
incredible.
It was fortunate for me. And it, again, it was circumstantial that I was a Bondo fighter. And I met, you know, Richard Bustillo taught there. Actually, I had my first heart attack there because I went to train and I had my Bondo t-shirt on. Had a big Bondo symbol on it. And of course, I knew who Richard Bustillo was. You know, he was the Iron Dragon. He was Dan's partner, you know, but he was rough. He was, when I say he was rough, he came off as being tough. You know, Guru Dan, always been Guru Dan. Mm-hmm. You know, you could go up and hug the man if he didn't know you, and he, you know, he'd hug you back. But Richard was tougher. You know, he, you know, most people don't realize, you know, he was a sheriff at one time. He did a lot of the, Dan used to talk about how he likes to jump out of planes and climb mountains and stuff. I don't know why he likes that stuff, but he was very tough. And he came up and goes, "You can't wear that shirt." You know, and I'm like, "Oh, crap, I'm going to get the crap kicked out of me now." And he goes, and he didn't say it mean. He just said, "You can't wear this." He says, "We have a policy here that we don't want to insult anybody who may be offended by different styles."
Mm-hmm.
You know, I guess you could almost find a comparison to today. One of the ways we have so much division, one of the ways to prevent people from being offended is everybody wears, it's kind of like having uniforms in school.
Yes, sir.
And so that's what they had. They had a t-shirt that was their uniform because they wanted to prevent any kind of conflict because someone may have a bone to pick with someone from Bondo. Because mm-hmm. in the martial arts, there's a lot of that.
Yep.
In the Filipino arts, there's a lot of that. You know, and so, you know, I bought a t-shirt and that's what I wore. But it's like when you have someone like Richard, and he's, I'm short as it is, and he was about 8 inches taller than me. So he's looking down at me and, you know, in later years when I met him, you know, he was a very gentle man. And, well, you know, when you get older, you tend to get gentle because you can't kick anybody's butt anymore, no matter how good you are. So I met a lot of really interesting people that summer.
Mm-hmm.
And then over the year, the next, you know, however many decades, and I'd go visit Guru Dan, he would take me places. I would go with him to train. I mean, I hate saying that was the best years of my life because that kind of depressing. I mean, so every part of my life has been great. But that certainly was, for a 20-year-old young man, was certainly exciting.
Yeah, sounds like a dream.
Yeah, well, yeah, you know, and I can remember when I first met, that first summer, he took me, it was either that year or the next summer, he took me up to the California Martial Arts Academy, which probably doesn't mean anything to you, but they used to have a thing called the Aspen Academy of Martial Arts in Colorado in the 70s.
I've mid-70s. Heard about that.
And the Aspen Academy of Martial Arts, I think it lasted 3 or 4 years, but it was the whole summer. And you could go and train for 1 month, 2 months, or 3 months in one art, two arts, or three arts.
Wow.
And Guru Dan was always there. Tim Tackett went there, and he taught Jeet Kune Do. Guru Dan would go and teach Filipino arts because, you know, Guru Dan had promised Bruce Lee he wouldn't teach Jeet Kune Do. Yes. So the one way he got around that was he taught privately. He wouldn't teach it commercially.
Mm-hmm.
He would teach it privately and teach, and he'd have his top teacher,
mm-hmm.
who was Tim Tackett, who would teach it. And that way Dan would be keeping his promise to Bruce Lee, which mm-hmm. he has to this day. Which is a shame. But
yeah.
And he would teach people privately because, you know, I had a lot of opportunity in the early years to do a lot of one-on-one stuff mm-hmm. with him because we'd just be somewhere. And Dan never stopped training. I mean, he was always thinking about it. I can remember we'd be out at dinner, me, him, Paula, and he'd be eating, and then suddenly he'd take his knife and his fork and he'd be doing this kind of, you know, it can be embarrassing at times, but it's like the mind of a master that, you know, you're so focused on trying to figure things out.
I was going to ask you if there were times where it was always martial arts or if there was times where he just...
Well, Guru Dan and I were, I think, probably, I don't say I was the exception, but my guess is Guru Dan got different groups of students that he talks about different things about. And Guru Dan knew that I was an academic
mm-hmm.
and knew that I was interested in more than just being able to fight or whatever. I was interested in the culture. I was interested in the science, the true science. And so he and I had a lot of conversations. Philosophy was one of my undergraduate studies, areas of study. And so we talked a lot about the philosophy. And it's interesting because I had students over the years like Steve Braun, who was a history major, and he knew a lot about history. And he would bring a book he had found for on Filipino history, and he would give it to Guru Dan, and of course Guru Dan already read it, but they would sit there and talk, and that's where you absorb stuff, because I was not a history person. And Steve was, and still is. So yeah, that's one of the great things about that kind of environment we have. Although I will say that martial artists often are very one-dimensional.
Yes, sir.
They can't talk about anything. When I would have parties, before I got married, I would have parties at my house all the time, invite my martial arts students and invite my colleagues from the college and all. And after a first few of them, I had to tell my martial arts students, you can't come if all you're going to talk about is martial arts. If all you're going to do is go downstairs and try to watch all of my videotapes, you cannot come. Because what happened is my martial arts people came over here, and all my other, you know, my colleagues, my friends and social friends, and they're over here. And it's like, I said, that's not what the point is. And so I'd have to actually force them to get involved with everybody else and leave the martial arts behind. And I'm sure you have found that.
Yes, sir.
And Dan is a lot deeper than that.
Mm-hmm.
But Dan sees the world through martial arts. But he sees all the complexities. You know, mm-hmm. He sees his politics. He sees his history. He sees his philosophy in those terms. In the same way, a lot of people who are very religious.
That's true.
Will see life and be able to discuss life through their religion, which doesn't necessarily make it easy, but you know, it's just how it is. And so, yeah, I had a lot of great times. And when I would go out and visit, which I did quite often, because my wife knows, I never went on vacations. The only time I ever left was I would go to California to train. So my vacation was always training, because I was never a vacation kind of guy. Mm-hmm. So I'd always go out, because to me that was the best stress reliever I could have. And like I said, I would go out there, and I got to be real close with Simo Paula. They actually had their wedding reception at my first house in Baltimore City. I don't know if I ever showed you the picture.
You did show me the picture with the cake.
Because, I mean, and that wasn't something that was planned or they did, but they had come out. They flew to Las Vegas, got married, then they flew out the week that right after that to train with me and my Bondo teacher for a week.
Yes, sir.
Because my Bondo teacher, John, was Guru Dan's first Bondo teacher.
Wow.
Then a few years later, I flew out to Pittsburgh, and Don Garone, I think Steve was there, Steve Braun came along, and myself took Guru Dan out to meet Dr. G in Athens, Ohio.
Oh, really?
So, yeah, we Guru Dan flew out, 4 or 5 days early, because Don was having him out for a seminar in Pittsburgh, like he did a couple times a year. And then, I want to say it was 85 or 86, and we drove out there and trained with G for a couple of days. And it was, you know, it's interesting because G, in trying to impress Dan, pulled out things I don't think anybody had ever seen. And I got to see him. Like, I saw all these great pictures of, I saw a picture of Dr. G with Gochin Yamaguchi, who you may not know who that is. Gochin Yamaguchi was the founder of Goju Karate. He was called the Cat.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, wow, that's amazing. Because G was a fifth degree black belt in Goju, I believe. I think it was fifth degree. Yeah. But he had studied, because a lot of the modern Bondo that we do, that is done in this country, mm-hmm. especially what they call middle style Bondo, has a really large Japanese influence.
Really? I didn't know that.
That's why I don't practice it much.
Yeah.
Because I like more of the letway, the kickboxing.
Yeah.
I learned all of the middle style. I just don't really, and I can teach it to my guys if they want to, but it's not, the form's great. I love doing forms, but I like the kickboxing.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of great adventures, Guru Dan, and Don Garone. I met Don Garone. You know Don?
I do not.
You don't know Don? He used to be all the seminars here, but he moved down to Atlanta, so he tends to stay down there. He's a instructor for the TSA. He teaches them how to fight terrorists and stuff. But in 84, Dan came out for his second seminar in Maryland. His first seminar was in 83, and I'm assuming you want a little of this kind of history.
Yeah.
His first seminar was he may have been here before. First seminar I was aware of in Maryland was in 1983. It was a year after I had gone that summer. And he was teaching in Bethesda. There was a Wing Chun instructor named Ray Mars, who Dan was friends with. And Ray would bring Dan out. Ray Mars was also Steve Braun's Wing Chun teacher. That's how I met Steve Braun. Actually, I met Steve Braun because we both were taking a Chinese calligraphy class at Maryland.
Very cool.
But when I went to visit, I couldn't afford to go to the seminar that Dan was giving in 83. It was the end of my senior year, and you know, I was a poor senior. But I wanted to go out and see him because I saved all my money. I only went to California or to camps. I couldn't afford to go to seminars too. So I went out and saw him, and this is the first time I had seen him since that summer. So it had been about 8 months. And I went out, and, you know, he hugged me, and I said, "How you doing?" I said, "Yeah, you know, Guru, I'm trying to find your new book," and his book on equipment had just come out.
Yes, sir.
If you've seen that book on, I forget what the title is, but it was on equipment, or it may have been his second sequel to the Jeet Kune Do book.
No, it was. It was like a martial arts training equipment or something.
Yeah, it was either that, yeah, and he also did Absorb What's Useful book. Mm-hmm. I don't remember which one it was, but I couldn't find it anywhere. And I told him, I said, I can't find anywhere. He goes, "Give me your address and I'll send you a thing so you can fill it out." I mean, well, a week later, there was a signed copy in my mailbox to me. And I go, you know, that's a special man that will go out of his way for an ordinary guy like me.
Yeah.
And, you know, all these little things like that is really what made me come to really love Guru Dan. And I always try to tell people, I said, you know, he's, you know, probably the greatest martial arts instructor alive today. Certainly in his breadth of knowledge, there may be martial arts instructors that know more in a specific art, but in his breadth, because he has, even Guru Dan has teachers, but in his breadth of knowledge, I don't think there's anybody can even come close to him.
I don't think so either.
That being said, I always try to tell people, he's not just the greatest martial arts instructor. I said, he's a great human being. I said, he's got a kind of personality that is a gift few people have. I certainly don't have it, because I'm not patient like Guru Dan. But he makes everybody feel they're special, and that's a gift. Dan's been able to, in a lot of ways, remain childlike.
Yes, sir.
You know, and I always tell people, the goal in life is to remain childlike without remaining childish.
Mm-hmm.
Because a child sees the world in a very particular way. Right? They don't judge the world. They just take it in for what it is. They're curious about it. Also, I like to use my dogs because, you know, we'll be out walking, my wife goes, "Why is he licking that thing?" I come here, that's how he experiences the world, or that's how she experiences the world. I said, they experience it through taste and smell. We experience it through sight.
Yes, you know?
I mean, we have five senses, but our strongest one is our sight. Dogs' strongest sense is their smell. Mm-hmm. I said, imagine if you could smell the way we see, and that's how dogs smell. And I said, they're experiencing the world, and they're always excited about something new. And children are the same way. They're always excited about something new, but they don't value judge it. Not right away. They may value judge it eventually where, I don't know, I'm interested anymore. But... And Dan's always been like that. That's perhaps why I look at him and I'm amazed. I say, how can that man travel like he does?
That's true.
And that may be because I don't like traveling, but it's like, how can he travel? How can he do the same thing he's been doing, literally? I have known him for 35 years, and he's doing not that different of stuff. And he loves it. I'm like...
He really does love it.
I'm like, God, I learned it 35 years ago with him, and I'm bored. You know, I can't see, you know, I want to stay in the art. I love the art, but it's like, and I do like doing, if you're a kickboxing mentality, you do like doing the basics over and over again. But, man, you know, you just think about how long he's gone, how often he's gone, how much he's sacrificed, his wife Paula has sacrificed. That's a lot of strain. You have to be able to approach people from their perspective, not your own. Martial artists oftentimes, and that's why they're one-dimensional, want everybody else to understand why martial arts is so great. And they never will.
That's right. Even each style.
They won't understand. Yeah. Well, they won't. The average person won't understand why you're so enthusiastic about it.
That's
right. In the same way, I cannot understand why people like watching sports and get crazy. Because I don't watch sports.
Yeah.
My family does. You know, I do not understand that. And, and now I don't disrespect it. I honor it because that's their. I understand I have things that are like that. But I don't understand that specific desire to watch other people play sports. And... other people are not going to understand my desire to want to do martial arts.
That's right.
And they don't have to understand it. All right. But if I try to force that on them, all right, they're going to be resentful. And in a lot of ways, I think Dan and I were close because Dan always respected me as the academic because he himself came from that. You know, he had a graduate degree when people, especially a Filipino man, didn't get graduate
That's
degree.
Right. And it was important in his family, too.
Absolutely.
He said his sister was the first Filipina teacher in California.
And, you know, he respect that. To this day, Paul says, you know, he would love to go back and get his doctorate. I said, oh, yeah, when's he going to find that time?
Yeah.
But now there's so many, I mean, he's so great. I was trying to figure out, because there's no list really anymore. They used to have that list on the website of all the instructors. Because I was trying to extrapolate exactly how many active students, not instructors, but students Guru Dan has touched. Because that would be not even, not just directly, but indirectly, because if this person, say like Rick Young, and I don't know how many schools he has or whatever, but even the students that have met Guru Dan, if they learn from Rick Young indirectly, they're students of Guru Dan. They're like in the martial arts, we would call them grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so I was trying to extrapolate that, but without a number, how many instructors there are, it's really hard to get a number.
I mean, there's, my gosh, so many.
And then there's a lot of people that are not formal instructors, but still go to the seminars and pass on what Dan teaches, right or wrong. Because there are a lot of people that they'll get promoted to, and this is one of the biggest problems. I mean, this is another reason I think Paula and Guru Dan, especially Paula, always liked me, is I've never done it for profit.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I've never had any financial incentive to misrepresent anything. And also, I guess having a PhD, I don't, you know, that's a pretty big deal to have those three letters.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's not like I'm getting any more credibility or my ego's being stroked anymore by being an instructor on the Guru Dan. I mean, it's great, but I always told people it was never about that. It was more about the experiences I had with him. And to this day, it's about spending time with him, which I don't get to because that happens when you get older. Mm-hmm. But when I do, it's always, you know, a lot of laughs.
Did you ever think about that? Doing it, teaching full-time professionally?
No. Never. I mean, I actually have thought now that I'm at retirement age where I can retire, I thought, you know, well, depending if I won the lottery, because I'm not going to put my retirement at risk, but if I won the lottery, you know, to me what would be ideal is to win the lottery, buy a building, and be able to have people come and train for next to nothing. Just enough to cover, like they do here. They give me $30 a month to cover like our water, because they have the cooler, and they go through with water. Well, there's no air conditioning.
Yeah.
We're not soft like you all. We train hardcore. We train, it's 95 degrees or, you know, 20 degrees. We're training in that garage. But, you know, hey, it's okay. You know, Bondo people are, Filipino people, all soft. It's okay. I understand that. I remember I have a video somewhere of Guru Dan from an old seminar in the 80s, him saying, Bondo rules. And I said, I'm going to send this to Chai. And I used to threaten to send it to Chai. And he always said, don't send it to Chai. Because, you know, when I first met Chai in 85, he knocked my contact out.
Really?
Well, he knew I was a Bondo guy, and he wanted to.
Was there some competition between Bondo and Muay Thai?
There's always been competition between Bondo and Muay Thai.
Really?
Depending on whether you buy the story or not, there are people that believe that one of the legends, historical legends, is that, in fact, Thai boxing came from Lat Wei.
Oh, from...
Because, and this we know is accurate, when Burma conquered Thailand, they killed the king, and they took his son, the prince. It begins with an N, I don't remember. But, and he grew up, spent some time in the Burmese king's, as one of his sons, and that learned Lat Wei. And then the legend is that, I want to say like Naroda or something, but the Thai prince fought 9 Burmese boxers and beat all of them. And where they fought is where the border for Thailand and Burma.
Really?
And I don't know if it's, you know, it's legend.
That's a cool story.
But that's the legend. And the Burmese will say, well, yeah, but he won because he was using Lat Wei. And the Thais will say, oh, no, he already knew Thai boxing and he was...
So,
And he did because he didn't own me. Uh-huh. You know, master. But after that time spent with him, I trained with him for a while. I think he developed a lot of respect because when I would go to California, if he had a fighter that he was training, he'd ask me to spar.
Mm-hmm.
Because he didn't have confidence that there was somebody else that was of a ability level to prepare him. I mean, my size. You know, if he had a fighter my size, obviously I'm not going to fight someone that's 50 pounds heavier. So, yeah, you know, I had a good times with all these people.
Guru, of all the, because Guru Dan, up to this day, is still in love with every single martial art that he sees. You know, he showed us a video recently. I was with Guru Daniel Linero. We were doing some privates at the academy. And Guru comes in, he's all excited, he's like, you have to watch this footage, and, or he wanted to review the footage of, like, a private that he had just done, and, you know, he's doing Cambodian boxing.
Yes, he's doing with Master Bond.
And, I mean, he's, like, hitting pads, and his coach is working him hard.
Absolutely. Well, you know, that's one of the main reasons I want to get back out to California, because Guru has said he'll take me to meet Master Bond and train with him. And, well, it's Cambodian boxing, and and, of course, according to Master Bond, Lat Wei and Thai boxing. So I said, that's great. Okay. And the Cambodians have this great weapon. I don't know if Master Bond teaches it, but it's just very, I don't even know what it's called, but it's kind of like a tonfa or the Mysox.
Uh-huh.
You know, the Mysox. Yeah. But what it is it's a full half of a tree, half of a, I guess, bamboo tree.
Uh-huh.
And so they put it here, and, you know, they have the handles that go over here, but they sharpen each end.
Cool.
So, you know, you can stab with it, but it also acts to block. And I saw a video, you can find it on YouTube, but I can't remember what the name of the weapon is. And I don't think Master Bond knows that, but I'm hoping maybe he knows somebody that knows that.
That's very cool.
And yeah, so, you know, it's always, and as I get older, you know, now that I'm approaching 60, I'm 20 years older than Dan was when I first met him.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's a lot of shared and mutual, and Dan, I also understand that he's got this relationship with a lot of different people, mm-hmm. but I can remember when I visited him a few years ago, and after we trained, you know, I always go out to eat, mm-hmm. but it was so late that that Thai place they like to go was closed.
Yeah.
So we went to the IHOP.
Uh-huh.
And I got there, and Guru and I got there early, and his students hadn't shown up quite yet. And then as they started to walk in, he would introduce me.
Uh-huh.
And he'd go, "This is my old student, Pat Finley, Dr. Pat Finley. This is my old student." And I look at him and go, "Guru, are you saying I'm old because I've been with you a long time or because I'm old in age?" And this is Guru Dan. He goes, "I guess both." Because, you know, he does that. I don't know if you've ever seen him. "I guess both."
Yeah.
That's a thanks. And from then on, he likes to make the jokes about age.
Uh-huh.
And you'll see, if you go to like Atlanta, where there are a bunch of older guys of us or whatever, he'll make comments about it. This is why he starts talking about, when you get older, you can't always do everything you did when you're younger. Because all of us, like Don and myself and LaVon Martin, you know, we're in our 60s or close to it.
Yeah.
And we were in our 20s, you know, when I started, when I was in my 22.
Wow. I used to see Bud Thompson around, you know, when I...
I knew, you know, and I met Bud the first time, probably the only time, actually, the few times I went to the original IMB.
Uh-huh.
And the original IMB, you know, was that in Torrance, too? I think it was in Torrance.
Torrance or Park.
And that's where I met, it might have been Carson City, I don't remember. I met, Cass the first time too.
Oh, really?
Yeah, because Cass had just come from, he's Canadian. He had just moved from Canada to train with Guru Dan.
Wow.
And he was over there squatting, and, you know, Guru would come, "Can you go help him with the squat? He's not done." I said, "I'm not getting involved here." And I can remember I was in LA once when Ron Bellicki first moved from Chicago.
Wow.
And I had to take Ron Bellicki to Salim Asli's apartment because Salim was traveling in Europe or something doing seminars, and Ron didn't have anywhere to stay.
Uh-huh.
And I had a car. So I drove Ron to Salim's apartment, which I'll tell you about off camera, but interesting place. I got to meet a lot of these people over the years and then seen them grow.
So, Guru, as a lifelong martial artist, you know, you've obviously had a lot of other accomplishments in academia, in your personal, you know, lots of different things. Suffice to say, martial arts has influenced probably all aspects of your life, but how do you see it? How do you see martial arts as influencing and shaping?
Well, I would say when people ask me, I say the first and most important influence would be my family. Hmm. I come from a very large Southern Irish Catholic family, very successful family.
Mm-hmm.
I was probably the black sheep. I was the least successful for the longest time. Five brothers and sisters. Amongst the five of us, there's an Army colonel, Navy captain, lawyer, and three PhDs. Okay. All-American lacrosse player, English National College rugby team player,
wow.
Naval Academy graduate, West Point graduate. So I don't even go into high school about all of their accomplishments, but mm-hmm. suffice to say, the martial arts was something that my brothers had never done. Because mm-hmm. growing up as the youngest of four boys, oldest and youngest girl, but you're not compared to them, you're compared to the boys. Mm-hmm. I followed three brothers who excelled at everything they did.
Yeah.
Academically and athletically. And that's why my parents knew that I never was able to find my identity, because I was never that good a student. I was never that good an athlete. But once I found the martial arts, that became my passion. And so I tell people, my family was obviously my first influence. It's a very, you know, very traditional, strict Catholic family.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I'm considered the heathen of the family, it was a very strict Catholic family, you know, raised that way. A very disciplined, authoritarian father. Was not mean, never abused us, mm-hmm. but, you know, discipline. Yeah, he expected, that's one of the things that I think is the, I don't want to say a problem, but one of the things I see lacking is in both teachers and parents, You put high expectations on your young people, they'll rise to the occasion. Mm-hmm. You don't, and they won't.
Yeah.
All right. So just my little side, I'll step off my soapbox. But so I would say that other than my family, martial arts is the single most biggest influence.
Yeah.
It is the thing that it gave me the discipline once I got my focus back to become more academically, just better academically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, I was a mediocre C student in high school. I was a C student in college. Mm-hmm. It wasn't until I got into grad school, once I could learn to use the discipline and everything like that. Of course, I won't say that the reason I probably was a C student as an undergrad is I spent too much time at the gym training, but I won't go there. But so, yeah, without a doubt, the martial arts is, and I would say, and my wife will probably tell you this, everything in my life is defined by that.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it be the people I relate to now, people I feel comfortable relating to, my interests, or lack of interest. Like I said, I'm not interested. I'm not even interested in watching martial arts.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a spectator.
Yeah.
But I like doing them. I like reading about them. I couch whenever I'm teaching or my wife and I are, you know, I'm trying to explain something to my wife. I couch it in martial arts terms.
Yeah.
Which can be both good and bad because a lot of times they don't understand that.
Yeah. I do that too. Even in my role managing nurses, I'll talk about it all the time. I don't know how much they like it or appreciate it.
But. And you know, there's a lot of things you probably may not even realize, but as you examine your life, there are things that you do that come from that you don't have to talk about, but because of who you are, that's how you approach it.
That's true.
I think that both you and I are fortunate in that we fell in. Bonda was always a lot like Dan's group, too. It was not structurally formal.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And because it's not structurally formal, there's more of a family atmosphere. Because I've trained in traditional schools and whatnot, and you have your traditional teacher-student relationship, and there's a need for that, and that's great. But from a interpersonal perspective, the Bondo and the way the Guru Dan and his umbrella group, how they function, mm-hmm. to me, worked better for me.
Yeah. As a Catholic or as a Christian, how do you find it ever like a challenge to reconcile it with your faith practice or your beliefs?
Well, see, now you're going to get into the philosophy of religion, which is something I love to talk about. But the reality is, we can rationalize anything we want,
sure.
in any way we want. And when it comes to religion, I always, you met Mayhak, who's my, as she puts it, she's mm-hmm. my hijabi goddaughter. All right. And she and I have a lot of conversations about religion. Because being Islam in this country,
mm-hmm.
and being an immigrant from Pakistan in just the last 3 or 4 years, which is what her family immigrated, and choosing to wear the hijab.
That's right.
There's going to be a lot of issues. But what I tell her, I say, you know, I'm going to challenge you about your beliefs.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're asking me, you should ask her, because you're talking about a woman that comes from an ultra-conservative religion.
Yeah, that's right.
Where we gave a demo, her, myself, I just really was more of a support. But her, my two Pakistani brothers, mm-hmm. who are now in Pakistan for the summer, Tarak, which I don't know if you met him,
mm-hmm.
He's my Sudanese via Kenya Muslim. We gave a demonstration at the Islamic Circle of North America, or maybe the North American Islamic Circle, I forget, in Baltimore. Mm-hmm. Man, 30,000 people there.
Wow.
It was back about a month and a half ago in Baltimore. It was all over the news and all. And you know, I sat back and I got to watch. I advised them, I mentored them on how to do it, but I don't get involved because you're not going to learn if I run mm-hmm. it. So they ran it. And it was for the kids. And we had two different age groups. We had young kids, and then we had more of the 11, 12 to teenager.
Mm-hmm.
And to see the faces of the young girls when Mayhak was up there demonstrating, it really was just like you don't get it until you see that. Because here are young women. And most of all of them are in hijab. Some of them are not, but most of them are. And they were just mesmerized because they didn't believe or had never been told that an Islamic woman, a hijabi woman, could do this.
Mm-hmm.
And Mahak's actually very good.
Yeah.
And she's very into it. And she was sparring with them. And she was doing stick work. And, you know, we didn't do any grappling.
Mm-hmm.
But just to see that. And so, and I'm sure you have found this, there are going to be Christians that martial arts is the devil's work.
Mm-hmm.
And there's actually a really good, I don't know if I still have a copy of it, there was a paper the guy wrote, massive, thing about how martial arts was antithetical to Christian beliefs and that it was the devil's work. And and I faced that when I first started martial arts. Again, I came from a very strict Catholic family. My older sister, who, you know, Catholic schools all across the board, Catholic college, all that, she felt that there was, I don't say devil worship, but that there was something wrong because I bowed to my instructor. And she didn't understand that culturally that's like shaking hands. It's a sign of respect or saluting in the military. But there's a lot of people that do that. And you could do that. I mean, if I were Christian and that's what I choose to believe. And therein lies the key, is religion is not rational. And so
that's right.
Great religious person named, I don't know if you're familiar with, you probably heard of Albert Schweitzer.
You remember
Albert Schweitzer? Most people know him as a humanitarian, but he was actually a religious, he was a great theologian. And he wrote a book back at the turn of the century, turn of the last century, where he had taken 200 scholars, and they were working to try to prove the historical existence of Jesus. Not using the Bible, but, and he wrote a book called In Search of the Historical Jesus. And it came out, you know, 1899, 1902, or somewhere around that. And a nice book and all that. And at the end of the book, final chapter, final page, he says, can't do it. I'm paraphrasing, basically. I can't do it. Can't prove that Jesus, even to this day, we really can't prove that the Jesus of the Bible historically existed. But his very last sentence was, but what I've come to realize is it doesn't matter. All that matters is you, that you believe. And ultimately, that's what, when I talk to Mac, I say, your religious, your beliefs are just that. They're about your faith. And no one can ever criticize you for your faith, but they will try. And you need to be able to understand how they will criticize you. All right. Or they're going to get the better of you. And so she and I have very in-depth, because I, you know, I tease her, I say, so, you know, Mac, you know, I've read the Quran twice. How many times have you read the New Testament? And she'll blush and go, I've never read it. I go, well, okay, so I guess, you know, you're kind of like racist. Even though you can't be, you know, Muslim, Islam is not a race, it's a religion. So when people say you're being racist against Muslims, well, you can't be racist against a Muslim, but you can be bigoted. And so I tease her about that. But we have a lot of conversations about that. Because, and the same is true, your question is, of course, you know, I have validated, because that's what people do. I can cite you scripture that validates what I do. I can cite you scripture that validates slavery. That doesn't mean it's a good thing. The nature of religion is that we, especially in living in an American society, is we can cherry pick what we want. That's fine. It's about what you believe. It's, and if you believe it, you believe it. It doesn't have to be empirically proven. So yeah, absolutely. I mean, my favorite verse, my mother used, you know, stitched, gave me a stitch, and I have it all over, is 2 Timothy 4:7. I have fought the good fight, I have finished the race, I have kept the faith. And for some reason, the reason that stuck with me is because there was a movie, what was it called? It's a true story, a true movie. I can hear the theme song. It won the Academy Award that year.
This was like those Olympic runners?
Yes. And in it, they cite that quote. And I had watched the movie, and it had a very profound effect on me. That, you know, because I was fighting at the time, and I always told people, my training, when I train because it was the way I worshiped.
You know, there's a quote in that movie where someone asks, I don't remember the characters' names or anything, but something about, like, why they run or something like that. And one of the guys was saying, like, well, when I run, I feel like I'm doing the Lord's work.
And that's exactly how I've always tried to explain to people. That's how I've always felt about my training, is that I do, and I will say it, it has expanded over the years, too, because I always felt like it was a form of worship, if you will. Because And there was another great Catholic theologian from the mid-last century named Paul Tillich. And Paul Tillich, he wrote in his book that a man's religion, today I'm sure we would have to say a person's religion, but a man's religion is his ultimate concern. It's got nothing to do with God. He says, whatever your ultimate concern is, he says, that's why for some men, it's money.
Yeah.
Because that's their ultimate concern. For some people, it's aging, because that's their ultimate concern, not aging. He says, so unless you can say that everything you do is for God, then you have to ask yourself, is that truly your religion?
Yeah.
Now, that being said, I will also say that I was born a Catholic, raised a Catholic. I would probably die a Catholic, but I don't really consider myself a Catholic. Largely, now that being said, if I had kids, raise them Catholic because that's what I know.
Yeah.
My wife, very, very, she's again Italian Catholic, very strict Catholic. And the reason I say that is, it's what I feel comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there are things that I would say arguably it's because of my martial arts training, I don't agree with.
These are fundamental
dogmatic beliefs. And so there are Catholic churches I had thought about going to, but they're really liberal and they're not looked upon, you know, as being Catholic. But I have one of my biggest problems, and I had this discussion with Mayhak, my hijabi goddaughter, is I have the same problem with Islam. Is you're not equal. Women are not equal. I don't care what you say. Nuns are not equal to priests.
That's right.
And I told her, I said, you can't be an imam. She goes, well, I can be a scholar, but you can't be an imam. And I said, if you're saying that separate but equal is true, well, then we have a whole lot of problems in our society because our society has said there's no such thing as separate but equal.
Yeah.
All right. If you don't have equal, and I'm not saying that, that's why I also have a problem when people say that you can be anything you want. No, you can't be anything you want.
That's right.
But you should have an opportunity to try and be anything you want. All right. I'm never and never was going to be an NBA player, but I had the opportunity to try and be that. I was going to fail because genetics didn't go my way. But in when it comes to Catholicism, you know, that's probably my biggest issue. Now, I love Francis. I think he's, especially when he said dogs are going to heaven. Man, I'm on that man's side. Yes, he said that he felt that that animals, pets, go to heaven. And, of course, St. Francis was a big pet lover, big animal lover.
Yeah.
But I think he, I like him. I don't always like him getting involved in politics, but, you know, maybe if the Catholic Church over the years had gotten more involved in politics, they might have said something during the Second World War. Oop, am I allowed to say that?
Yeah.
All right. And it took them 50 years to apologize for that, looking the other way, so that they wouldn't be smacked down.
Yeah.
But that being said, you know, that's the main issue I have with the Catholic Church. I also, and I don't want to insult any Catholics because, you know, I married in Catholic Church, you know, my wife's Catholic. It's kind of boring.
Yeah.
I like that's why I say I like some of the newer, in the 70s they tried to do this, and I guess some places, where they tried to make it more content, and maybe that shows a lack of religious discipline on my part.
Yeah.
Because I also like the Latin masses.
Mm-hmm.
And in my church where I grew up, and you know, I was an altar boy, I was the only high school student ever to be on the church council. But we had a deacon, not a deacon, well, a deacon, he was a priest, but he wasn't the main priest. But he would say the church, he would say that you could go to a mass and he would say it in Gaelic.
Oh, really?
Because he was Irish.
Yeah.
And of course, I'm of Irish descent. And so that was kind of cool. Yeah. Didn't understand a word he said, but it was kind of cool.
Yeah.
So, you know, I like where they do the same. That's why I love a lot of the I'll call them fundamentalist church, because there's, I go into Catholic service and it doesn't seem like there's a lot of joy.
Yeah.
You go into like an AME church, and they're just happy to be there. But in the Catholic church, it's like they're repeating the stuff, but they're not thinking about it.
Yeah.
Because if you're forced to repeat the same thing over and over, you stop thinking about it.
Yeah, that's true.
And, you know, again, those are my personal issues,
which
is funny because I like jab cross. That's, I could do that all day long, but I don't like the going and having the church do the same thing.
Yeah.
But no, I would have to say that, yeah, absolutely. I'm never going to throw off what I was raised in.
Yeah.
And I have always tried to validate what I do with the Bible. You know, I also can validate it with other religions too, but especially with the Bible.
Well, it's interesting what you say about religion. Abraham Lincoln has a quote that's something similar to, when I do good, I feel good. When I do bad, I feel bad. That's my religion. You know, and I think ultimately, I think that's true. You know, you can claim to be very religious and having God as the center of your life whatever else it is. But if you're concerned with money or success or prestige, then ultimately that's probably what your religion is.
And, you know, I would throw it just a little bit. There's nothing wrong with being concerned about those things because that's how you're going to live.
Sure.
It's whether it's your ultimate concern. And that's what Paul Tillich was saying is, and for some people it's their family.
Yeah.
And that's great.
Yeah.
But the reality is if your family is your ultimate focus, well, you're not focusing on God.
Yeah.
All right. And I don't necessarily know if that's what God would want anyway.
Because
he wants you to do certain things, I believe.
Yeah. for someone that's just getting in, or maybe someone that's been doing it for a long time, for the longevity of martial arts, either for the physical training, the application, or just like the, you know, keeping it as a cultural component, someone's part of their identity, what do you think the secret is for, not the secret per se, but do you have any tips about staying training and staying interested and motivated?
I would give them, anybody, the same advice I give students that come to me in my office at the college. Do it if you enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't enjoy it, you're not going to stick with it.
Yes, sir.
So, you know, enjoy what you're doing. I would also say don't take it too seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Don't take it too lightly.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a middle path. And as I have told my students, certainly don't take it too seriously because you have family and mm-hmm. you have other things that are, trust me, martial arts is not the most important thing. Mm-hmm. It may have the biggest impact on your life, but it's not going to be the most important thing in your life. If it is, good luck to you. It's a sad life because, yeah. I mean, there's so many other things in life. And I would say that that's what I've gotten most out of martial arts and my association with Guru Dan is the desire to look at other things. Mm-hmm. You know, when I look at, just like when I first met Guru Dan, he was talking to me about different martial arts and all. Now when I meet other things or, you know, see other things involved, like food, you're a foodie, you know. Mm-hmm. If I could change one thing about my life, it would be to be a foodie, but I don't have that kind of palate.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I don't like a lot of foods, but I like that there are a variety of foods and I'm always trying to find different foods that I will like.
Mm-hmm.
Now I see someone like you and my wife, y'all have so many different things. It's such a blessing. I mean, I watch those cooking shows or that guy that travels all over the world. And I'm like, on CNN, I'm like, oh, this is like, there's so much life to experience there. Just like I like traveling different cultures and I would love to learn different languages.
Yeah.
That to me is the height. I mean, you speak a lot of languages.
Yeah.
Because Helen Keller said, Helen Keller was blind and deaf.
Mm-hmm.
And the quote that sticks with me, she says, blindness separates you from things. Deafness separates you from people. So if I had, but back to the martial arts, I would say, don't take it too seriously. Have fun, but don't take it too lightly because then you're going to disrespect your teacher. So, you know, you should be serious about it, but it shouldn't be so serious that it's the most important thing, mm-hmm. at least for your whole life.
Yeah.
Part of your life, that's fine. Especially if you're competing, I can understand it being very important, especially if you're getting paid, if it's a livelihood. If it's not a livelihood, well, then you better find another line of work
because
I can earn money off of it.
Eric Paulson said something like that in an interview. He said something like how your passion, what did he say? He talked about that, how he's lucky that his passion is also his occupation, his livelihood. But I think it's related to what you're saying. Like you have to put things in perspective and understand where they are.
Well, when students come to my office and they're trying to figure out what should they major in,
mm-hmm.
the first question I ask him is, what do you like to do?
Mm-hmm.
Second question I ask him is, what's important to you?
Yeah.
Now, that shows my bias because some people would reorder those questions.
Yeah.
Because for some people, what's most important to them is not the same thing as what they like to do or love to do.
Mm-hmm.
All right, 'cause for some people, if I'll have a older student come in, it's maybe a young man now, but early 30s, just got laid off his job, got a family, two kids. And if I ask him, what do you like to do? He might say, I like to fish or I like to drive my car or this or that. But then when I say, what's important to you? He says, my family. Well, that changes what I might recommend him do because it may be a matter of he needs to find something he can, you know, get an education more quickly,
mm-hmm.
like a trade or something that we do at the college that he can make a decent income because he's got family.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to if I have an 18-year-old, I say, what do you like to do? Because you have time to work on that.
Mm-hmm.
And I have always, I've been very fortunate. It's everything I've ever gotten to do in my life, I've loved doing.
Yeah.
Which is, that's rare. For, I know there's a lot of people that get to, my best friend worked in a job while he liked it. It wasn't what he would have chosen to do.
Yeah.
But he didn't have an education.
Mm-hmm.
So I would certainly say that, have a passion, but remember really what's important. And a lot of martial arts people miss that.
Yeah, that's true.
They miss that.
I agree.
They don't understand. You can have your passion, but there's still a lot of things that are more important than the martial arts. It's not the most important thing in the world.
Yeah.
Unless you're doing it for a living and supporting your family. That's different. Yeah. And something else, that Sensei Eric told me recently actually was interesting because we were kidding with Mayhack. He, me, him, Mac and myself. And I had that shirt on that had the basically the Crusader,
uh-huh.
what it was, and you know Mahek's there, and I didn't realize it. I didn't even think about it because it had Pendecker Paul's quote on it. That's all I saw. And so you know we're all chuckling, and Eric goes, "What religion do you think God is?"
Huh.
When we were talking about you know Islam, and because Eric's very religious.
Yes.
All right. But and he's Catholic, but not quite, because he's got some beliefs that are way outside the, you know, he'd be excommunicated for it. I don't think he realizes that, some of the stuff he likes to get into. But, and I thought, you know, and Eric, I had a lot of adventures with Eric, too. And Eric is one of those guys that's a brilliant mind, but he's truly got a childlike mind.
Yeah.
Outside of his martial arts.
Yeah.
He sees, and to me, that was, like, profound. Mm-hmm. What religion is God? And it's like, you go, like, and you can't say anything.
Yeah.
And his point was that, you know, religion is good, but God loves all religions because what religion is God?
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Guru.
Thank you. This
great conversation.
Fun. Enjoyed seeing you.
Yeah, always great. We'll have to get the kids out here to say hello
absolutely.
To you
we
guys,
can come
too.
Out come swimming sometime. We don't even get the pool to never get used. Seriously. My wife and I don't